They keep coming, the allies, the neutrals, and those who, in the late president's words, would make themselves our adversaries. For example, Anastas Mikoyan, the wily old survivor who served Stalin and now Khrushchev, first deputy premier of the Soviet Union, expected tomorrow from Moscow. President Johnson will be meeting at least the heads of these national delegations after the funeral late tomorrow. But first, the young widow, Jacqueline Kennedy, will receive them, her final White House reception. Mrs. Golda Meir, the Israeli foreign minister who grew up in Milwaukee and has been a frequent visitor, found this a heartbreaking visit. It seems too terrible, she said, for words to express. And the foreign minister of Brazil, João Augusto Araújo Castro, mourned the president. The world, he said, has lost a great leader. Willy Brandt, mayor of encircled West Berlin, arrived with tears in his eyes. The people of Germany, he said, feel very sad. They share the mood of the American people at this tragic moment, but Berlin and the American people will stick together. That was the comment of Mayor Willy Brandt. Most of the visitors will be gone by tomorrow night or Tuesday. Gone like West German Chancellor Erhard. He had been scheduled to come on a happier mission. Had President Kennedy lived, he would have arrived today for a business visit, one of those periodic Allied consultations in which, for the first time, Erhard was to have taken the place of the venerable Konrad Adenauer. Now it is a briefer, sadder mission, but like the thousands filing through the Capitol under the rotunda tonight, these leaders of foreign nations wanted to be here, wanted to be part of this moment of national grief. Ellie Abel, NBC News, Washington.
Among other notables since arrived are Prince Philip of England and Prime Minister Sir Alec Douglas Hume. We will continue in a few moments with The Highest Price, the life and times of John F. Kennedy.
We pause now 10 seconds for station identification.
WWJ and WWJFM, Detroit.
And now, from a name and a voice well known, another assessment of President Kennedy.
This is Mel Allen. This reporter found himself with an open weekend and following the weekly gridiron goings-on and took off for a quick fishing trip to Nassau on British soil. Late Friday afternoon at nearly 5 o'clock, returning to the dock, I suddenly noticed British flags at half-mast. I turned to the skipper of the little fishing boat and asked, "Those flags weren't at half-mast when we left a few hours ago, were they?" He, as well as I and my companion, were unsure. And so it was that on the waters of the Atlantic, we stopped a sailboat headed in the opposite direction. Hailing its skipper, we asked if he knew why the flags were flying at half-mast. He yelled across the open water, "President Kennedy has been assassinated!" A shocked, stunned group suddenly burst out, "My God, no." And silently we hoped that he was mistaken. And thus it was that just a few hours ago, I stood almost on the very spot where President Kennedy stood to be welcomed by the then Prime Minister of Great Britain, Macmillan, in the historic Nassau Conference. Flying back to New York to participate in this tribute to our late president, my mind wandered to the time it was my privilege to have met him not quite 2 years ago, when he attended the National Football Hall of Fame Foundation dinner here in New York to pay tribute to many outstanding American citizens who, like President Kennedy, in their youth were athletes in their college days, and to pay tribute to sports in general. I recall that he seemed so relaxed in an atmosphere that held great appeal for him, even to the extent that he insisted on a program for all Americans, which he fervently urged them to follow, his physical fitness program. And I was proud to have been a member of his physical fitness committee. As he said, to be strong intellectually and spiritually, we must develop and utilize our physical skills. We are an under-exercised nation. But he thrilled the spectator sports as well. He threw out the first ball to inaugurate new baseball seasons. An avid football fan, too, he recently recalled his 21st birthday, not because he had come of age and was eligible to vote, but because it reminded him of a football game. Many of my boyhood heroes, he said, were football stars. And I can tell you from personal experience that even as President of the United States and until he drew his last breath, many of his heroes still were from the world of sports. When Babe Ruth's record was broken, he invited the man who broke it to the White House. As he said, "I still thrill to a long run, a solid block, or a good tackle. I'm like a lot of other Americans who never quite made the team, but love the game." And so in this hour of national and worldwide grief, may I offer this prayer to his memory, a prayer written by a priest whose identity we have never been able to find, but expresses the sportsman's creed and the thinking, too, of our late president, whose zest for living included that great love of sports. Dear God, help me to be a sport in this little game of life. Play me where you need me. I only ask for the stuff to give you 100% of what I've got. If all the hard drives come my way, I thank you for the compliment. And God, help me to remember you won't let anything come that you and I together can't handle. And help me to take the bad breaks as part of the game. Help me to realize that the best part of the game is helping the other players. And finally, God, if fate seems to uppercut me with both hands, help me to take that as part of the game also. Help me not to whimper or squeal that the game is a frame-up or that I got a raw deal. And when in the dusk I get the final bell, I ask for no lying complimentary stones. I'd only like to know, God, that you feel that I've been a good guy. Even now, as the shock begins to ever so slowly wear away, we remember him, too, as the author of a book, which, even as in sports, spoke of the many challenges and the dangers of America's great statesman. The hand that wrote it has been stilled by an assassin's bullet, but sadly, it also wrote that book's epilogue, another of the profiles in courage. Sports at a time like this? Yes. For he loved them. And after all, ladies and gentlemen, sports are just games of rules. But one of the greatest rules ever to be handed down to us is the golden rule. Another way of saying sportsmanship. Another way of saying America. Another way of saying John Fitzgerald Kennedy. This is Mel Allen in New York.
In the city of Washington tonight, in the national capital, a touching story of love and devotion, as reported by Bryson Rash.
Shortly after 9 o'clock, Mrs. Jacqueline Kennedy, accompanied only by her brother-in-law, the Attorney General of the United States, Robert Kennedy, came here to the rotunda. The two of them went inside the rope. They came up the great stairway on the east portico. They were recognized by police, and the crowd was moved aside, the great crush of people, so that these two people could come into the rotunda. They went inside the velvet-roped-off area, where is the catafalque and the casket in which the body of the late president rests. Mrs. Kennedy alone went to the side of the casket. She genuflected, touched the casket, and the flag that drapes it turned and departed. Her eyes were moist. The Attorney General met her halfway, took her arm, and led her back out through the crowd, through the portico. She stopped several times to accept the well wishes of several ladies in the crowd as she walked by. Her appearance was an emotional peak which triggered tears among many of those standing by. The two of them then walked out of the out onto the east portico, and a handful of reporters had spotted her and started out immediately after her. The Secret Service man turned to us and said, please keep a respectful distance, which we of course did. The two of them walked down the great staircase where just a few hours earlier the body of her husband had been borne and placed in its point of respect. They walked down the staircase, and at the bottom was the big limousine ready to take them back to the White House. Mrs. Kennedy shook her head and said, no, I would rather walk. The two alone set off across the darkened plaza. They walked across the little grass strip there, and behind them, one Secret Service man, several Capitol policemen. There was no one there, of course, but as they got beyond the Senate wing of the Capitol building itself, they turned left and plunged through a large group of people that were milling about on the sidewalk. They were not recognized. Mrs. Kennedy wore a black dress, a black coat, and a black scarf, which was pulled back from her face. Again, followed by the Secret Service men and two or three Capitol policemen, they walked down Capitol Hill. This meant they walked over grass under trees, dodging between parked automobiles and no sidewalk, of course. Many people were coming up Capitol Hill, and they did not recognize Mrs. Kennedy nor the Attorney General. This included several Capitol Hill policemen. They finally got down to the bottom of Capitol Hill, at first in Constitution Avenue, and there people began to recognize them. They stopped for just a moment, and another well-wisher came up to say hello. And Mrs. Kennedy paid her respects. At the moment, walking into the rotunda is the President of Ireland, Éamon de Valera. He is accompanied by many of his officials. The President of Ireland has come to the rotunda to pay his respects to the late President of the United States. There was a large group of gentlemen with him. Secretary of State Rusk is among them. The Irish ambassador, Mr. Kiernan. The President of Ireland, accompanied also by the United States Ambassador to Ireland, Mr. McCloskey. They have paid their respects, and now they walk off to the right. A large group has just come into the rotunda, headed by the President of Ireland, Éamon de Valera. With him is Secretary of State Rusk and the Irish and the United States Ambassador to Ireland, Mr. McCloskey. They stand for a moment and talk. And now they walk back across the rotunda and are making their way out of the building. Throughout the evening, there have been a number of these visits. Dignitaries of many nations and of all walks of life have come to pay their respects to the late president. But now, to return to the story of Mrs. Kennedy's outing, at first in Constitution Avenue, they had been recognized by this time by perhaps 20 people. They fell in behind the police and the few reporters. And the Attorney General and Mrs. Kennedy then turned and walked south on First Street. They met a large group of nuns. Mrs. Kennedy stopped for a moment to accept their condolences, and she thanked them. They walked on farther south on First Street. And at this point, the Attorney General said something to Mrs. Kennedy. She nodded in agreement. The traffic is extremely heavy on the streets in this area, and the Secret Service man called police. Traffic was stopped. And the Attorney General and Mrs. Kennedy then weaved their way through the stopped traffic to the limousine that had followed them down Capitol Hill. And they got into the limousine and went back to the White House. This moment of privacy, alone in a great throng of people, while Mrs. Kennedy had lasted perhaps 16 minutes. The amazing thing about it was that so few people recognized her. And secondly, that she made this walk and visited this area with such a small amount of protection. the respect of the people who did recognize her was enormous. They kept their distance and permitted Mrs. Kennedy, the widow of the president, and the president's brother, the attorney general, to be alone in the midst of this great crowd. Later in the evening, perhaps an hour after Mrs. Kennedy had visited here, four ladies of the Kennedy family also came to the rotunda to pay their respects. Mrs. Rose Kennedy, the mother of the president, Mrs. Eunice, Ethel, and Joan Kennedy. Miss Joan Kennedy is the wife of the senator. Ethel is the wife of the attorney general. Eunice is the wife of Sergeant Schreiber, the director of the Peace Corps. The four of them came. They went inside the small enclosure where the catafalque and the body of the president lies, and kneeled, and for just a moment, recited a silent prayer, and then they too left. A moment ago, the president's brother-in-law, Stephen Smith, appeared here to pay his respects. Apparently, throughout the evening, there will be other visitations by members of the Kennedy family and by close friends and by relatives, members of the family. This is Bryson Rash reporting from the rotunda.
A reporter well acquainted with the new president, Lyndon B. Johnson, the successor of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, is NBC's Robert Abernathy. And here is his story.
I was talking one night with Lyndon Johnson's longtime assistant, George Reedy. It was just after the man who is now president had surprised many of his friends and agreed to John Kennedy's request that he run for vice president. What kind of man is this, I wanted to know. I had watched him as majority leader of the Senate, standing with his hands in his pockets by his front row desk, speaking so quietly we in the gallery could hardly hear him. I'd known his reputation as a persuasive Senate operator, a man who knew his colleagues instinctively, knew how to reward them or threaten them or plead with them to get something done. I'd known his reputation as a rather flamboyant Texan. But what kind of man was he, really? George Reedy, I knew, was one of those many persons who've worked for Mr. Johnson for years, endured much, long hours, sudden changes of plan, and yet developed fierce loyalty to their boss. George Reedy, I knew, was by no means an objective source, but he had something important to say. I believe it more today than I did then. I've learned to agree with him. The senator, said George Reedy, speaking of the man who is now president, is like a combat general. There's much truth in this. Don't think of a chief of staff or a Pentagon planner. Think of a battlefield commander, perhaps a George Patton. Lyndon Johnson is tough. He admires power and its decisive use. As a congressman on the Naval Affairs Committee, as a senator on the Armed Services Committee, its Preparedness Subcommittee, and on the Space Committee, he has been concerned with national security. He is proud of the process of our government, and as majority leader of the Senate, he often seemed more interested in getting action than he did in the precise nature of the action. He can be expected to command and to lead. The questions then are, can he lead, and in what direction? Taking the second question first, the question of direction, those who know Lyndon Johnson best doubt that there will be any major change in foreign or domestic policy. When he was a senator from Texas, Lyndon Johnson got a conservative reputation. He was representing his generally conservative state. But when he was a congressman in the 30s, it should be recalled that he ran for office as a 100% Franklin Roosevelt New Dealer. And since he was elected vice president, he's been down the line with John Kennedy policies, active particularly not only in space development, but also in equal employment opportunities. Lyndon Johnson's directions can be expected to be the same as John Kennedy's. And can he lead? Certainly in those processes of government which require personal contact and persuasion, President Johnson will be effective. Effective, by the way, is one of his favorite words. He wants to make things happen. The skills he developed as majority leader of the Senate will serve him and the country well. As an executive, however, as the master of a complex machine, he may be less experienced. He operates personally. He's always had a small staff. He may find it difficult to be the chief organization man in the country's largest organization. He can be expected to become angry at bureaucracy. But the presidency is more than personal contact among men, more than executive processes. It is perhaps above all things a position requiring the ability to touch the hearts of a majority of us. I've watched and listened to Lyndon Johnson on the campaign trail, standing before a strange audience in a strange city, reaching out for them with words and stories, trying to find what will move their hearts. When he speaks ad lib, when he's with a sympathetic crowd, Lyndon Johnson can be, as he wants to be, most effective. He draws out country stories and, believe it or not, can be very funny. But a president cannot so often speak ad lib. A president must read out loud. John Kennedy was a master at this. His style was literate, polished, thoroughly educated. He was effective on television. Lyndon Johnson will not do this nearly as well. He has other gifts, many of them, but this, reading a speech, is not one of them. We will all have to adjust to this and to the difference between the accents of Boston and the West Texas hills, between the products of Harvard and Southwest State Teachers College. But once we do make the adjustment, we may find that underneath that unfamiliar twang and manner, there is a man of great strength, of great physical strength, but also of the strength of purpose which commands support. His greatest immediate problem will be to communicate this, and ours to let it be communicated. This is Robert Abernathy, NBC News, Washington.
Another of NBC's reporters well acquainted with the new first family is Nancy Dickerson.
It's always said that in America, a man can be born in a cabin and rise to the presidency. That's exactly what Lyndon Baines Johnson has done. He's truly a modern Horatio Alger. Few men have started with less. His parents could give him little more than encouragement and spiritual values. Mr. Johnson is very proud of his humble start. The little wooden frame house where he was born is smaller than the living room of many American homes, but it is the first thing he shows to all the famous guests who visit at the LBJ Ranch in Stonewall, Texas. Often, after long hours of campaigning, President Johnson likes to reminisce. He talks about those early days when he was a shoeshine boy in Johnson City. Mrs. Johnson has always campaigned with her husband. She used to be somewhat shy, but now she's very articulate on the campaign stump or whenever she gives speeches anywhere. She does know politics as well as any woman. The Johnsons love to go to their ranch in Texas. It's there that they get into their ranch clothes, they ride, they relax, they entertain their old friends, and they spend time with their two daughters, Linda Byrd and Lucy Baines. Both are teenagers. President Johnson loves to tease his two daughters, and they are very proud of him. They're also very unaffected, even though most of their lives have been spent in the limelight. Lucy Baines has lots of boyfriends. Linda is engaged. She may be married next summer. We might even see a White House wedding sometime next year. Mrs. Johnson is a remarkable woman. She never seems to lose her composure, even under extraordinary circumstances. I well remember the day in Austin, Texas, when 14 of us reporters reporting on the campaign landed at the airport there. The hotels were all filled. It was convention time. So Mr. Johnson invited us all to the ranch for the weekend. He called ahead to say that we'd all be there. But such surprises as that never seem to faze Mrs. Johnson. She just takes them in her stride. Her nickname, Lady Bird, was given to her shortly after she was born. A nurse looked at her and said, "Why, she looks just like a little Lady Bird." And the nickname has always stuck. Her real name is Claudia, but even in the congressional directory, she's listed as Mrs. Lady Bird Johnson. Her best friends call her Bird. The Johnsons used to have a medium-sized house in Washington. Since he was elected to the vice presidency, they moved to a bigger place, a 9-bedroom mansion. They installed a heated swimming pool. It's a therapeutic measure. Heated swimming was suggested for Mr. Johnson by his doctors after his heart attack some years ago. Despite that heart attack, the president keeps such a fast and long pace that his aides have a tough time keeping up with him. And that goes for those who report on his activities, too. President Johnson loves to have people around him. He loves to talk with them about politics in peace. Since he was elected to the vice president, see, the Johnsons have entertained extensively, both their old friends as well as government officials. One of their most notable characteristics is their naturalness, their ability to be in the limelight, but to be unaffected by it. This is Nancy Dickerson of NBC News at the Capitol.
Despite his periodic trips abroad, much of the world feels it does not yet know Lyndon B. Johnson. President Kennedy had proved himself during times of crisis. A firm stand on the Russian missiles in Cuba. A quick response to repeated Soviet harassment along the Berlin Autobahn. These had given our allies around the world an awareness that the U.S. and its policies abroad do not fold up under communist pressure. But this feeling had developed before the tragic assassination. And now the question, what of the future? Will the Johnson administration be a continuation of Kennedy foreign policies? What of the Atlantic Alliance and of the war in Southeast Asia? An appraisal of the dramatic events of the past few days and what they mean to the future as seen in major capitals around the world. First, to the NBC post nearest the Iron Curtain, John Chancellor in Berlin.
The main question being asked here in Berlin tonight is, will the death of President Kennedy make a difference in the status of West Berlin? And the answer, from qualified observers, is no. That does not mean, however, that there will be no trouble in the coming weeks or months in Berlin or on the Autobahn which links it with the West or in its air corridors. The position of Berlin as a jousting ground for both sides in the Cold War was not altered or changed during the years of the Kennedy administration, and it is not likely to change during the tenure of the Johnson administration. The West will not pull out of Berlin short of war, and the Soviet Union will not start a war to force the West out. That was true under Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy, and it will be true under President Johnson. However, Berlin is an exposed, surrounded outpost tied to the West by slender and vulnerable threads in the air and on the ground. Since 1945, the Soviet Union has been whittling away the Western rights of access to Berlin. And that was going on earlier this month when the Russians held up an American convoy on the Autobahn. The dispute on the Autobahn is an ancient one by Cold War standards, and it remains unresolved. It appears likely that there will be other confrontations on the Autobahn, perhaps more erosion of Western rights on the road. But the Western commitment to West Berlin itself is too fundamental to the balance of politics in Central Europe to be changed by the death of one man, no matter how important he was, no matter how much he is mourned. But Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union are another matter. It is true tonight that the presses and transmitters of East European and Soviet propagandists are preparing an indictment of invective about the handling of the Lee Harvey Oswald case, and that the murder of President Kennedy will be depicted behind the Iron Curtain as the work of the extreme right in the United States. That is annoying, but perhaps not fundamental. What is fundamental is that the leader of the European communists, Nikita Khrushchev of the Soviet Union, had a working relationship with the leader of the West, John Kennedy. And these two men, with their enormous power and influence, had begun to set out some ground rules for peace and for an attempt at relaxation of the tension between the two powerful systems. The Test Ban Treaty was one example. The hotline between the White House and the Kremlin was another. The Russians recently puzzled the world when they arrested a distinguished American scholar for so-called espionage, but they returned to the fundamental agreement when President Kennedy personally intervened. The scholar was released because John Fitzgerald Kennedy put on the heat. Now, one of the two men accustomed to this high-level dialogue is gone, and means will have to be found to get it started again. That will take time. While it is going on, there will be further attempts to widen the commercial and cultural contacts with the countries behind the Iron Curtain. And these attempts will be led by America's allies in Europe, by the West Germans, by the British. The personality of John F. Kennedy had in the past been able to exert some American influence and control on these widening contacts between the West and the countries of Eastern Europe, contacts which bring both promise and danger to the West. In this field, the new American president will have his hands full. Wheat to Russia, most favored nation status to Yugoslavia and Poland, credits for expanded trade. They are all complicated. They are all critical to America's role in the new Europe. President Johnson faces a hard task in determining the course of American policy in these churning European waters. John Chancellor, NBC News, Berlin.
The Johnson administration and the unpredictable Charles de Gaulle is reported from Paris.
The president is dead and a new president is in office, and already throughout Europe and particularly in France, a big question is being asked. What does the tragic death of President Kennedy mean for the future? The French understand with their customary clarity that there is no more important individual in the Western world than the man who holds the office of President of the United States. For it is by his decision that the awesome power of the world's richest and most potently armed nation is wielded. Up to the moment of President Kennedy's assassination, President de Gaulle disagreed with many of his basic decisions and policies. President de Gaulle thinks very little of the United Nations as a peacemaking organization. He believes that the North Atlantic Treaty Organization ought to be reorganized to give the United States a smaller role and France a larger role in basic alliance policy. He is developing France's independent nuclear force despite American objections against nuclear proliferation. He does not believe in discussions with the Russians until they demonstrate that they are ready to make concessions. He has barred Great Britain from the common market. He has his own conception of European unification on the basis of national states and the Franco-German Treaty of Friendship. He is intent on eliminating American influence in Europe. In fact, President de Gaulle has been challenging American leadership on this continent and has considerable reserves about the basic view of the late President of the United States on Atlantic partnership. All this makes quite a list of disagreements, and the list is by no means complete. Nonetheless, there is another side, a basic side, to French policy. It consists in complete loyalty to the Western Alliance as the essential framework of defense against the threat of communist aggression. In short, the agreement between France and the United States can be described as more basic than the disagreements, which are within the pattern of the alliance and aimed at attaining a greater voice within it for France. But the alliance itself has never been called into question, and as the Cuban crisis last year demonstrated, the United States has no ally more loyal than President de Gaulle. None of these French policies are likely to change as a result of President Kennedy's death. But in the highest French circles, there is some concern about what will happen to American policy. For President de Gaulle had a deep regard for President Kennedy. French ministers who have de Gaulle's ear have often told me that they, the French, if they had been American, would have handled matters exactly as President Kennedy handled them. There is no higher praise from one poker player to another. But President Lyndon Johnson, for the French, is an unknown quantity. He has already announced that he will follow the same foreign policy as that of President Kennedy. But there is always a style, a personal note to the way policy is pursued. And the French wonder whether President Johnson will have the size, the dynamism, the knowledge, the judgment, and the decisiveness that is required by a post of such awesome magnitude. I put this question to one of France's highest officials yesterday afternoon, and his reply was, "It is impossible to predict. Only the future will tell." This is Bernard Frizzell, NBC News, Paris.
Latin American reaction, where the Alliance for Progress has not been an unbounded success.
Argentina remains completely stunned by the assassination of President Kennedy, and for the moment at least, all differences between the two countries have dissolved, with Argentina joining the rest of the world in mourning. What will follow remains a question mark. But at this moment, there is no doubt of the sincere, deeply felt grief that the Argentines share with the United States over the loss. However, the questions most asked of all Americans living in Buenos Aires today is, who is this new president and what is he like? In truth, Argentina, perhaps the best informed nation of South America, knows almost nothing about President Johnson. And with the new government of Argentina just 6 weeks old, they've had all too little time to prepare themselves for the fantastic events that have followed. This was clearly visible in the abrupt halt to just about everything in Argentina until the government can come up with an estimation of what lies on the road ahead. Argentina and the United States currently are engaged in a serious dispute over the nationalization of the Argentine oil industry and the annulment of oil contracts with the United States firms. Late Friday night, Foreign Minister Zavala Ortiz was to have delivered a major foreign policy address to the people of Argentina, presumably concerning Argentine-U.S. relations. The speech was postponed immediately upon receiving the news of President Kennedy's death, and it probably never will be delivered. Argentine Vice President Carlos Peretti and Foreign Minister Zavala Ortiz are in Washington today, not only for the funeral, but to try to get some feeling as to which way the United States winds now will blow under President Johnson. For the moment, the net effect on Argentine politics of the still unbelievable succession of events is that Argentina stands unified in bewilderment. The politicians and the government of President Illia seem to have forgotten all of their differences and are moving as a solid, unified bloc. The cabinet of Dr. Illia, which had not met even once since its appointment because of a wide range of differences, went into a solemn session which was described as singularly harmonious. But obviously, the government and the people of Argentina are waiting to know only one thing. How much friendship can they expect from President Johnson? What they have to work with now simply are past speeches by Mr. Johnson, with words such as those he issued on the second anniversary of the Alliance for Progress when he said, "In the long run, what has been started during these 2 years will have greater significance for the life of all of those who are called Americans than anything that has occurred in preceding centuries. Together, we will reach success." This is Ed Arno, NBC News, Buenos Aires.
Italy, troubled with its own political problems, takes a look at the White House.
The change in the American government through assassination coincides with a change in the Italian government through more conventional means. As in the case of Great Britain and West Germany, Italy, also a major member of the NATO alliance, is experiencing a change in leadership. There is anxiety in Italy during this period when its reins of government are changing hands. That anxiety is multiplied because Italy's main partner, the United States, suddenly has a new leader too. Instead of one unknown, a new Italian government, there are now two unknowns, a new Italian government and a new American president. Lyndon B. Johnson should not be completely unknown to the Italian public. He has visited Italy, but President Johnson is unknown. His visit to Rome in September of last year was brief. Mr. Johnson had a private 40-minute audience with the late Pope John, and he signed an agreement with Foreign Minister Attilio Piccioni to cooperate in minor space research. But few Italians turned out to see Mr. Johnson. The newspapers paid little attention to the visit. Italians are notoriously indifferent to visiting dignitaries. Even the Italian leaders with whom Mr. Johnson met considered his visit more ceremonial than anything else and did not take the trouble to probe his political philosophies. Thus, Lyndon Johnson's accession to the presidency finds an element of apprehension among Italians. Italians knew John Kennedy. They admired him, respected him, were in a measure influenced by him. They present to President Johnson in their newspaper editorials and comments by political leaders an attitude of wishing him well, but of knowing him not at all well. The unknown is always unsettling. The new Italian leader with whom the new American president will probably have to deal is Aldo Moro, 47, a studious law professor, a longtime politician, a man of unusual patience and low-pitched emotions for an Italian. Like Mr. Johnson, Aldo Moro suffered a heart attack several years ago, recovered, and has continued his active political life. Moro is leader of the Catholic Christian Democratic Party and is on the verge of forming a coalition cabinet with three other parties. He is expected to form his cabinet in the next few days, but even that is not sure. Moro plans to include in his cabinet members of the Socialist Party. This is a bold experiment. The socialists are Marxists and longtime collaborators with the communists. The purpose of this strange marriage of Catholics and Marxists is to accomplish a long-needed legislative program of economic and social reforms, which more conservative Italian governments have neglected. The price for socialist support, however, may be a loosening in Italy's ties to NATO. The socialists are basically neutralists. They are willing to have Italy remain in NATO, but they want her participation to be passive. The socialists oppose President Kennedy's plan for a NATO nuclear army. The old adage of a chain being as strong as its weakest link applies to the Western Alliance. The old problem of a recalcitrant France confronts President Johnson as it did President Kennedy. But for President Johnson, there may now be the new problem of a reluctant Italy. Irving R. Levine, NBC News, Rome.
More comment now from Latin America.
President Goulart's office announced today that the Brazilian government believes there will be no changes in relations between Brazil and the United States with President Johnson. However, the same announcement said President Goulart will spend today with his close advisors studying the hemispheric implications of the death of President Kennedy. That announcement sums up what Latin America expects now that Mr. Johnson is the new U.S. president. They hope the policies of President Kennedy will continue, but they fear they will not. Latin Americans had great admiration for and placed great trust in President Kennedy. President Kennedy initiated the Alliance for Progress. Latin Americans believe this signaled a new economic era. President Kennedy personally visited four Latin American nations. Nearly every Latin American head of state visited President Kennedy. Latin Americans heralded these visits as evidence that personal relations with the White House were the best ever. Latin Americans place great reliance on personal relationships. Their greatest compliment is that a man is simpatico, sympathetic, congenial, admirable. President Kennedy was all these. Latin American politicians tend to distrust someone they do not know. Latin Americans do not know President Johnson. Editorials hint that Mr. Johnson is a right-wing reactionary. These same editorials imply that Mr. Johnson will not continue fighting for civil rights. These same editorials imply that the interest in Latin America will diminish now that Mr. Johnson is president. These interpretations are either unfair, inaccurate, or far too premature to have any validity. So most Latin American governments will wait a month or so to see what Mr. Johnson says and does about Latin American problems, about the Alliance for Progress, about canceled U.S. oil contracts, about the Panama Canal, or military takeovers. If President Johnson follows President Kennedy's policies, there may be misunderstandings, as there were before. However, at least Latin Americans will know where they stand. Officially, Latin American governments say they expect no changes in relations with the United States. Unofficially, Latin American nations are worried that without President Kennedy, dialogues between North America and Central and South America will be less sympathetic and less cordial. Wilson Hall, NBC News, Rio de Janeiro.
The government of Ludwig Erhard and its response.
West Germany's new chancellor, Ludwig Erhard, is looking forward to close relations with the new president of the United States. Erhard is 66, Johnson 55. Although vastly different in temperament and background, both men are disinclined to experimentation in domestic or foreign policy. Neither, however, could be called a diehard conservative. These considerations, among others, lead officials here in Bonn to take an optimistic view of relations between the Erhard and Johnson administrations in the year ahead. President Kennedy gained immense popularity here during his June visit, but former Chancellor Konrad Adenauer and some members of his Christian Democratic Party had misgivings about the youthful president's strategy of peace. They feared he might sacrifice German interests or at least perpetuate the division of Germany in his quest for understanding with the Russians. There's no evidence that Erhard ever shared these doubts, although he is known to have shared the widely expressed feeling here that the Kennedy administration had not adequately consulted Bonn before concluding the partial nuclear test ban treaty with Russia. West Germany belatedly signed the agreement after complaining that communist East Germany should not have been allowed to adhere. Erhard was due to have conferred with President Kennedy in Washington tomorrow and Tuesday. As it turns out, he'll see President Johnson at tomorrow's funeral services and hopes to have a chance for political talks before flying back to Bonn, probably Tuesday. The West Germans are eager to learn the new chief executive's intentions about continuing exploratory talks begun by his predecessor with Moscow. Erhard also wants to know whether Mr. Johnson intends to press the proposal for a mixed-manned Allied nuclear fleet. The Germans have agreed to take part in such a force and to pay a share of its $4 billion cost. Officials here who've seen Mr. Johnson in action in Washington and on two visits to Germany while he was vice president have considerable respect for his political savvy, especially his ability to handle Congress. They think this may mean better relations between Congress and the White House, even in an election year. In general, the feeling here is that the new president will carry on his predecessor's policy of close Atlantic partnership and maintenance of powerful American forces in Europe. This is welcome. It will be less welcome if President Johnson should press Bonn to fulfill completely its NATO force goal of 12 divisions. West Germany now has 11 divisions with a 12th in formation, but these forces lack artillery, signal, engineer, and other backup units required to make an effective army. Balanced forces mean an unbalanced budget, something that Erhard has sworn never to allow. Whatever disagreements Erhard and the new president may have in future, they're likely to try to play them down. Both leaders are feeling their way, and both are pledged to preserve the German-American alliance. Wells Hagen, NBC News, Bonn.
The Western Alliance for many is symbolized by the longtime allegiance between the U.S. and England. Here is NBC's senior European correspondent, Joseph C. Harsh.
On the morning after John Kennedy died, the great tolling bell of Westminster Abbey spoke once each minute for an hour. The last previous time it tolled was when King George VI died. It had never before tolled for any American, president or otherwise. The throbbing hurt of that great bell registered a fact which had not until John Kennedy died been fully appreciated here. The fact that for the first time in history, our American president had become accepted and recognized as the true and lawful leader of the Western world. In the London Sunday Telegraph this morning, Peregrine Wirthorn perceptibly noted that if President Kennedy had lived out his expectable 8 years as president, men would be speaking of the Kennedy era, as 100 years ago they spoke of the Victorian era. He had become as much the dominant figure of these times as Queen Victoria was the dominant figure of hers. One could almost translate this into antique political definitions and say that he had in truth, if not in title, become the Emperor of the West. He was not controversial here in Europe. He is undoubtedly mourned more universally here than at home. For here he had no political enemies. He was accepted, trusted, and respected as much among the ranks of labor as among Tories. He was seen only in his role as world statesman, and in that role he had come to be regarded as decisively successful. He is given the credit for pushing back communism and saving the peace at the same time. He brought the world into balance. The British particularly have felt safe and secure during the year between the Cuban crisis and the death of John Kennedy. It will be a year towards which many a nostalgic backward glance will be cast, for here men cannot and do not yet look ahead with confidence. Perhaps the sense of pervasive doubt will swiftly be dispelled by President Johnson, but right now, in the shock of the loss of the known leader who had proven himself, people can only be anxious when the new leader in Washington is, to people here, the unknown president. Literally, no one here really knows Lyndon Johnson or much about him. He was a vague figure in the Washington background who spoke with an accent familiar here only in television westerns and on the vaudeville stage. That a man can speak with a Texas drawl and also be a world statesman is a possibility not before contemplated here. Perhaps it can happen. It never has yet. The fact that the trusted leader could in these modern times be assassinated in the United States is coupled with the unknown quality of his successor and sudden doubt about the outcome of next year's American election. The combination must inevitably, as it does, complicate the management of the alliance and affect the shape and direction of its growth. Certainly the British and French will be more reluctant than ever to leave alliance strategy and nuclear weapons entirely to the United States. The trend must be towards nationalism and independent lines of action. Confidence in a nation which can assassinate a great world figure is shaken, and it cannot be immediately restored. Already this morning, the former Sir Anthony Eaton, now Lord Avon, was saying that the death of President Kennedy will result in greater responsibilities for Britain. Behind that statement lies the thought that it must be some time, if ever, before the peace of the world can again be as solidly founded as it has come to be of recent times on the respect of Nikita Khrushchev for John Kennedy. One reason the peace was founded on John Kennedy was because he was expected to be reelected. Allies and enemies all thought ahead in terms of continuity of American policy for another 5 years. Now they have no assurance of continuity. The president could be Lyndon Johnson for a year and then some other person even less widely known. The possibility of three different American presidents in 3 years of time makes us begin to appear in foreign eyes to be as politically unstable as France did before de Gaulle. One danger is that the Russians will attempt to take advantage of the new uncertainty. If their behavior follows the normal patterns, they will test the new president with threat and perhaps with a new probing adventure. Another danger frequently mentioned here today was that America will get a rush of blood to the head and itself do something rash and unnecessarily dangerous. President Johnson now has the difficult and perhaps impossible task of winning for himself the confidence which our allies had placed in his predecessor. It took President Kennedy 2 years to win that confidence. It is asking a lot to expect it to be given in shorter time to another man. But to try to end this on a hopeful note, it is also possible that the allies will now be ready to shoulder a larger share of the burden of defending the West. Joseph C. Harsh, NBC News, London.
November 22nd, 1963. Shortly after noon, two shots ring out from an assassin's rifle, and the course of world history is changed. A young man dies, and all the world pays a reverent tribute. A president leaves the White House in a flag-draped coffin, and people everywhere share the grief of his wife and family. The simple statistics will list him as John Fitzgerald Kennedy, 1917 to 1963, the 35th president of the United States. But the statistics can never tell the story of love and admiration felt by the factory worker in Chicago, the housewife in Los Angeles, the man in the street in Boston or Tallahassee or Wichita. The act of assassination is foul enough, but for it to claim a young and attractive man, a person of dedication, president who in 2 years and 10 months did so much, this indeed is the highest price.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
This is Russ Ward, NBC News, New York.
Following a 10-second pause for station identification, the NBC Radio Network will continue its coverage as Morgan Beatty and the NBC News staff summarize this second unbelievable day following the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Immediately following this news program, NBC will present a short interlude, Alexander Scourby and the musical work The Testament of Freedom.
WWJ and WWJFM, Detroit.
Now for NBC News, here is Morgan Beatty.
The time by human clocks at this moment, 11:21 p.m., close to the total waning of the second day. The time by the calendar at this moment is November the 24th, 1963, almost 50 and a half hours after the assassination of the President of the United States in the county of Dallas, state of Texas. The time is less than 24 hours after the suspected killer was just as wantonly wounded fatally in the basement of the Dallas City Jail, before the listening ears and watching eyes of a whole nation, a whole world. The time has come once again to summarize this terrible and untidy span of time and the action that has taken place within its terrible sequences. As we broadcast to you now, the 80,000th plain citizen stands in a line 26 blocks long and several abreast in our nation's capital. Number 80,000 will soon pass in the double line before the catafalque where lies the body of John F. Kennedy. It was placed there just after noon today, where Lincoln and more than a dozen other selected American citizens have lain in state in notice of their service to the nations. On the minds and in the torn hearts of the mourners, who symbolize all of us, are the names of two men almost nobody ever heard of before 1 o'clock Eastern Standard Time on Friday. These two men, Lee Harvey Oswald, the loner, the American citizen who had not confessed, but who had been charged with the murder of the president and the wounding of John Connally, the governor of Texas. And that other equally bizarre character who, like Oswald, thrust himself unwanted into the history books of the world, Jack Ruby, a scrappy human cur, a product of the streets of the city of Chicago, now a resident of Dallas. He has admitted he took the law into his own hands. He dashed past police guards before noon today, thrust a snub-nosed .38 revolver into the soft stomach of Lee Oswald, who was being transferred from city jail to county jail, and fired. The bullet ended Oswald's life less than 2 hours later. Ruby told his sister in jail tonight, "I had to do it. Don't worry about me." In Washington, the security officialdom of the nation looked with shocked misgivings on the whole incredible tale from the Southwest. They heard with dismay the statement of District Attorney Henry Wade in Dallas County that he would not release the piece of evidence in hand. They were relieved shortly after when he agreed to release all of the evidence concerning Lee Oswald, the evidence concerning the end of the president's life. Federal authorities are positively committed, as is the mayor of Dallas, Earl Cabell. This record must be and is now being given to posterity. Back in Washington, a diplomatic mystery. What goes through the minds of the visiting dignitaries from around the world at this close to midnight hour? We cannot know. Our State Department had assured all nations that ambassadors may well represent any nation at the president's final funeral passage to Arlington Cemetery tomorrow. Nevertheless, 84 nations so far have deemed it important and meet, even including our primary rival in the world, Russia, to send the highest officials they can spare to Washington as a special mark of respect. Tomorrow they will take part in majestic passage from the rotunda of the Capitol to the White House and to St. Matthew's Cathedral for final requiem mass. Some will join the cortege at the White House with Mrs. Kennedy and walk the final five blocks to hear an appeal to a higher than human power for mercy on all men and their souls. That, in summary, is the series of events that will be written into history, a most unclassic sequence of tragedy, including all but its final and public act tomorrow. And now the summary in detail. First, to Bryson Rash, NBC News, in the rotunda of the Capitol of the United States.
The day here started at just before 2 p.m., but an hour before that, at 1 p.m., the president's body was placed on a caisson and taken, brought here to Capitol Hill. It was then lifted up the great white steps and placed at rest in the exact center of the rotunda, the head pointed directly west, the feet pointed to the east. And then, in very brief and moving ceremonies, there were three eulogies spoken. One by the Majority Leader of the Senate, Senator Mike Mansfield, by the Chief Justice of the United States, Earl Warren, and by the Speaker of the House of Representatives, John McCormick. A president's wreath was then placed in position at the foot of the casket in which lies the body of John Fitzgerald Kennedy.